This is Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast, episode number 186. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. This is another Gnostic Media epic episode, and this episode is an interview with Dave McGowan titled The CIA and the Magic of Laurel Canyon, and is being released on Sunday, December 1st, 2013. This interview with Dave was recorded today. And this interview has been delayed and rescheduled a number of times since March, and I thought Dave had disappeared for a while, but he was back after the Supilakis interview, and today we finally got this done. Dave McGowan was born and raised in the suburbs of Los Angeles, California, where he still resides. After graduating from UCLA in 1983 with an unused degree in psychology, he went to work in construction and now works as a general contractor. He is the proud father of three daughters and is a lifelong music fan. Donations. This episode was brought to you by the generosity of Lewis, Carlos, Peter, Janice, Tino, Jeremy, Matthew, Stephen, Marco, and Douglas, Richard, Samuel, Deb, Alan, Max, Joseph, and Paul. And while we do our best to provide just about everything here for free, your donations and website purchases are essential and what keeps Gnostic Media going. And I ask that you please sign up for a membership or make a donation because we just can't do it without you. And we also accept Bitcoin, Litecoin, and Primecoin donations. And please also check out the store page on the website where you have time to order for the holidays and you can get the Wheat Blows bumper stickers, bookmarks with the logical fallacies on the back, our books, the Gnostic Media Archives for the first 5 years. Those are now up and about 2 months before normal. And the She Remembers Archives, the Pharmacratic Inquisition DVD, a t-shirt, or a membership to the website to download the older shows. The views expressed by the authors and guests of this unprogram are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself, the host, or Gnostic Media. Check out the website at www.gnosticmedia.com. That's G-N-O-S-T-I-C media.com. You can reach me directly through the contact form on the website or at contact@gnosticmedia.com. Thanks for listening and thank you for your support. Here is my interview with Dave McGowan. The CIA and the Magic of Laurel Canyon. I know this has been a long time coming. Enjoy. All right, Dave McGowan. Welcome to the Gnostic Media Podcast. How are you doing, sir?
I'm good. I'm completely mentally and physically exhausted, but otherwise doing really well, actually. I mean, I can't really complain. I mean, I can, but... you know, in this economy, complaining about having too much work is, you know, isn't really something that we should be complaining about, I suppose. So
sure. It's
just kind of been a perfect storm of, I just got just ridiculously busy in the last couple of months at my real world job at the very same time that I'm trying to sort of finalize the manuscript for my book, and my publisher keeps sending back new stuff for me to work on that I don't have time for, and it's just been insane. And you know, it's all good, I guess. I can use the money, so I can't really complain, I suppose.
Well, you know, you and I were supposed to have an interview last March. We had one scheduled and it never happened, so I'm glad to make it happen today. And since then, myself and Joe Atwill put out a new article that cites you and parallels your research called Manufacturing the Deadhead, a Product of Social Engineering. And that caused a bit of a stir itself. And so it's, you know, it's been really important to us, your work. And so, you know, of course, having an interview with you about all of this stuff and looking at it from both of our angles and seeing what fits, I think will be good for everyone here.
Hey, one of the guys, you can correct me here if I'm wrong, but one of the guys in the Grateful Dead is currently a member of the Bohemian Grove. Is that true?
I think it's three of them. Bob Weir, Mickey Hart, and one other, possibly. So yes.
Oh, really? As many as 30?
Yeah. And Bob Weir, I've found videos of Bob Weir actually bragging about it. You know, he's pretty. He thinks it's all pretty cool. You know, they all run with the CIA groups, but of course Bohemian Grove from the Bohemian Club in San Francisco, that is actually the sister club of the Century Club in New York, the famous art club, quote unquote, and then that was run by Alan Dulles, and Alan Dulles and Aldous Huxley and Gordon Wasson were also there, and of course Gordon Wasson is the so-called discoverer of magic mushrooms, and which he stole from somebody else's research, John G. Bork from 1891, but all of these guys centered around either the Century Club or the Bohemian Club, etc. So we found a lot of this overlap, and we do know for sure that the Bohemian Club grew directly out of the Century Club.
Well, I did an interview with this other guy, I don't know, quite a while back, and he was apparently a big Deadhead, Deadhead from back in the day, the very big Grateful Dead fan, and he kept referencing them in the interview, and at one point said something to the effect of, "Oh, I'm just glad that my band, you know, wasn't part of that whole Laurel Canyon scene and don't have that taint." I hate to break your heart, Bob, but I'm pretty sure that Bob Weir is a member of the boat. And he was just, like, stunned, just, I just seemed to completely burst his little bubble, and
sure.
Almost felt bad for having told him that, but, you know, facts are pesky things, you know, and, yeah, I mean, the Grateful Dead, I mean, they're, you know, the association with Owsley, and you know, I mean, there's a lot of weirdness surrounding them.
Sure.
I mean, at one point they moved down to Watts, you know, with Owsley, and basically were running LSD trials out of some decrepit home in Watts that was right alongside a bordello, you know, which like exactly parallels what the CIA itself was doing at the time in San Francisco and elsewhere, was sort of using, you know, these bordellos to run acid tests and stuff. And, you know, here we have the Grateful Dead going down to Watts of all places, doing the exact same thing, not long, just months before Watts went up in flames, you know? So, yeah, the Grateful Dead, they have some very tantalizing connections, to say the least. But, yeah, he was under the impression that they were sort of, you know, above all of that.
Did you read our Manufacturing the Deadhead article that exposed their connections and how that was all manufactured? The whole look, dance, everything. Well, you know, and you heard, I know you did hear my interview with Supalakis recently.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, that was bizarre. You know, I thought I might actually be able to pick up a few little last minute facts to tack onto my book, but nothing she said had any credibility whatsoever. I mean, it was mind boggling.
Do you think that she was clueless, or do you think she's more of like a matriarch?
I don't know. It was hard to tell, you know. I mean, without meeting her face to face, it was hard to get a gauge on what her agenda was, you know. I'm surprised she even went on the air, kind of, you know. But she was very evasive, you know, whether it was deliberate or just, you know, her brain just isn't functioning at
all
cylinders nowadays. You know, she claims that they never did any drugs, you know, that these people were like drug free, you know, these people that were known as the acid drenched, you know, freaks of the movement.
Well, but
that
if they were agents, wouldn't it fit that, you know, if they're selling this whole thing to the rest of society, that they would stay clean? You know, it's like...
Yeah, that's true. And Vito supposedly did, you know, just like Frank Zappa, you know, and even Charles Manson, you know, limited his own intake while drugging, you know, that was kind of a... that was par for the course. You know, you had these kind of these guru type figures that had all of the little followers around them that they kept drugged while they themselves kind of, you know, maintained control over the situation, so to speak. So, it's quite possible, you know, but if Sue wasn't doing drugs back in the day, then I don't know what the hell's going on with her brain functioning nowadays, because she is really out there, man. I mean, yeah, that was a bizarre interview, to say the least.
And she had contradicted herself quite a number of times, and there were even more of them than in the final interview that I released, she had a number of contradictions from our conversation the day before and then the official recording. And I was, you know, I would bring up stuff that she admitted, and she would sit there totally denying that she had said anything about it, you know. And it's really interesting how, people who weren't part of the two or three conversations I had with her, you know, they're like, you know, a lot of them are trying to defend her. No, she's just old and, you know, she's really innocent. But there were so many just direct contradictions. And a couple of times she was trying to call me a liar for something that she said, you know. And if she knew that all of the agent, you know, the funny thing is she's telling me that she knows that their art store is a central hub. They know that FBI and other agents are in their art classes and stuff. And then she claims that, well, you know, they had to move north to get away from that.
Is that what she's saying? Some of her comments were just so bizarre, you know. I mean, like, it's very well known that their place was a crash pad and that people stayed over there regularly, a lot of underage. And that the bands themselves, you know, the Birds hung out there and rehearsed there. Arthur Lee and Love are on record as having lived there and rehearsed there. And yet she claimed that nobody ever, that people would come and visit for the day, but they'd never stay over at night. What she said something about, well, Vito took a nap every afternoon, and everybody knew that they had to leave.
He locked the door. Yeah.
Oh, what is she talking?
But, you know, the funny part was that, you know, they would come back late at night and then party all night, but they didn't crash there.
Yeah,
you know, so you got a bunch of people drunk.
Yeah, then they would come back.
Right, a bunch of people drunk and drugged out, coming back.
Yeah, I mean, and some of the things she said were just downright factually incorrect. At one point, she said something about, oh, yeah, there were people living at Tom Mix's old place, which was the log cabin, and across the street at Harry Houdini's old house, which burned down in 1959, had been in ruins for years by the time, you know. And yet she's claiming that people were living there, you know. So, I mean, some of the stuff that she said was just absolutely factually incorrect, and you know, there's no question about it. Some of the years that she got, she was like way off on when she claimed that different things happened, and it was just bizarre. I mean, I didn't really get anything too useful out of that, and she even claimed not to know some aspects of Vito's history. You know, I mean, didn't she claim that she didn't know that he had a Rockefeller connection or something?
Yes, she did. His cousin was married to Rockefeller.
Yeah, she claimed to have no knowledge of that whatsoever. That, you know, I mean, how could she not know that? You know, some of the stuff was just, I don't know. It's hard to say. Some of it was probably deliberately evasive, and some of it was just,
from what I can tell, his cousin Eva Paul was married to Winthrop Rockefeller.
That was confirmed for me by a member of the family who asked not to be identified because he said he's already gotten a lot of flack from other family members for spilling deep, dark family secrets.
We didn't even get that from you. We had found it from our own source. So, you know, that you had confirmed
you?
That. That's two of us looking at it from different angles going, those people are related, you know. And actually it was my co-author, Joe Atwell, that had found that one.
Yeah, which she claimed to have no knowledge of, you know, and several other things. That was a strange one, man. I mean, I was very excited when I heard that you had interviewed her, and I thought maybe I'd get a little inside you know, a little insider information that I hadn't heard before, but virtually nothing she said. I mean, I know from other people that I've talked to and other research that I've done that a lot of what she said just simply wasn't true. So,
and that's, you know, and that's the, you know, the interesting thing is that photograph of her that we used for that episode, it's like her standing there in the front and all of these people around her, like she is, you know, some sort of matriarch. And which would certainly, it would certainly explain her blatant lying during the interview, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would. And then, she also, at some point in the interview, she said that something about, when she said that they went up north to start a family or something like that, completely ignoring the fact that she had actually already started a family down here, and then the kid had mysteriously died at the age of two, which she completely left out of the narrative that whole, you know. It was just, yeah, it was some of the things she said would just stunned me. I'm just
wasn't that kid, didn't he disappear surrounding Anton LaVey and some what was that film called, Hollywood or something like that?
Mondo Hollywood, yeah. He had actually been according to, I think it was the San Francisco Chronicle reported that he had actually been handpicked by Kenneth Anger, disciple of Anton LaVey and whatnot, to play Lucifer in his film Lucifer Rising. He was the one that was originally going to be cast to play Lucifer. He was going to be the infant Lucifer, and then he died, you know, in this accident. And so obviously Kenneth Anger and probably LaVey had some, you know, connection, level of connection to Vito and Sue, obviously, or how would he have ever even hooked up with this idea of using the kid, you know? So, after the kid died in this mysterious accident, of course, he ends up casting, of all people, Bobby Beausoleil of the Manson family. So, yeah, there's all these weird interconnections between, you know, the Church of Satan and the Manson family and the Vito Squad and just a whole little sordid, you know, backdrop to all of this, which she conveniently left out of her version of events entirely. Never even mentioned her firstborn son, her only, you know, their only kid at the time, her firstborn and only son. Died at the age of two, like the day before Christmas, you know? It was like on December 23rd, I think, like 2 days before Christmas, you know?
Did you find out that she had gone dancing or something like that right after it happened?
Yeah, the kid died. According to his death certificate, he was pronounced dead at like 7 p.m., and, like, immediately afterward, Vito and Sue and the rest of their crew went out dancing at the clubs as if it was just another night. Yeah, their two-year-old son dies on 2 days shy of Christmas, and they're out dancing in the clubs literally within, like, minutes. You know, it was just so bizarre. And so, of course, yeah, she probably didn't really much want to discuss that particular chapter of her life, because that's a little hard to explain, isn't it? mind-boggling to me.
I thought of asking her point blank. Maybe I should have waited till the last question of the interview and an hour and a half in or whatever and dropped that one and see how she would have responded, you know, but I didn't want to have a 15-minute interview with her. I was hopefully trying to get something. I mean, there were a few little bits that we were able to get out of it. But, you know, it was astounding to me that, you know, there's nothing going on. You know, her statement that she had to go out and dance for Jim Morrison and all of this stuff, you know, it's like they're on the clock. They have to go out and dance. They have to go promote the horse crap, you know.
Well, they were major, you know, as I point out in the book, they were a major part of creating that whole scene and of building that whole buzz, you know. I mean, they're long forgotten now. They're definitely, you know, I mean, I never heard of the guy. I had never heard of the name Vito Pelicas, and nobody I know has ever heard of it. And it's very hard to dig up much information on the guy. It's all in little bits and pieces, a few sentences in this book, a few, you know. And as I was going through all these books, you know, doing the research, the first three or four times I came across the name, I just passed right over it. I'm like, I never heard of this guy. He's barely mentioned here. He's just, you know, mentioned in passing, can't be important. And it was only after the name kept coming up over and over again, just in these offhand references, that I realized there's got to be something to this guy, because he just seems to pop up everywhere. And so I went digging, and it's very hard to find much information on him. I mean, he's there, you know, he and his wife and their crew and his sidekick, Carl Franzoni, and the rest of the crew, they are all but forgotten now, but they were a major, major part of launching the scene, more important than the band. You know, I have quotes from people like, you know, Gail Frappa admitting that, you know, what originally drew people out to the clubs wasn't the bands and the music, it was the spectacle on the dance floor. You know, this is a whole new brand of music that just,
sure,
just kind of grew, emerged overnight, you know, the folk rock. Chloe, shh, be quiet, my dog's acting
up. Well, you know,
and, you know, all...
Oh, just, well, I just wanted ahead. I just wanted to throw in real quick, you know, when I would mention the Deadhead Look and Dance tour, you know, she kept saying she had no idea what that was. And meanwhile, she's the one who started thrift store, you know, going to thrift, you know, to design these types of clothes and stuff like that. And she had a store on Sunset or whatever that Vito Vito opened for her and designed for her so that it would attract... people that were misled to her, right, or something to that effect, she says during this interview, which was just a really weird comment.
Yeah, she did. Yeah, the Vito Clay Studio, which was not only the initial rehearsal space for some of these bands, but is also where, yeah, his wife opened the first, what is considered to be the first sort of hippie clothing boutique, you know, and introduced that whole look. So, I mean, yeah, they were hugely influential, hugely. I mean, the scene would have never got to where it was, you know, without them, because, you know, as people have admitted, these clubs were brand new. You know, they just started popping up like mushrooms in the 1960s, you know, just as if all these speculators knew that there was going to be this big music scene happening, you know, and these bands just all started popping up out of nowhere, but nobody had ever heard of these clubs, and nobody had ever heard of these bands, and nobody had ever heard this style of music. And what really set the ball rolling and got people out there was all the publicity that these freaks were getting, and this huge spectacle that they were putting on the dance floor, which also, by the way, served to mask the fact that a lot of the bands weren't all that good, you know, and if people were focused on the spectacle on the dance floor, they weren't paying attention to how bad the musicians were, you know, so they were hugely influential,
sure,
hugely in launching the scene and fashioning the look, the styles, the fashions, the hairstyles, the clothing styles, all of that. I mean, just hugely influential, and they are like almost completely forgotten now in all of the all the books that have been written on the era. You know, they just receive just a passing mention here and there.
Well, in my interview with her, she even denied that they were called the Freaks.
Did she? Okay. On Zappa's album covers, they were called that. And, you know, the song "Hungry Freak's Daddy" on the original Freakout album was dedicated to Carl Franzoni, you know, Vito's full-time sidekick. You know, I mean, everybody knew they were called.
She didn't know what the Deadhead Look and Dance was that she created. She didn't know who the Freaks were that she was one of the leaders of. You know, I mean, she's sitting there telling me that Vito told her everything, but then he never told her how he won the Groucho Marx Award, and, you know, which is kind of funny. And he gets, you know, the equivalent of like $50,000 or $100,000 or whatever to go get this this art degree in Rome, and you know, but she's totally clueless or totally lying about every detail in the interview. You know, and it's just so funny because when you go through and you understand how, you know, like as we wrote in Manufacturing the Deadhead, when you understand how Edward Bernays' role played into this, he promoted Vaclav Nijinsky, this effeminate dancer on stage in the early 1910s and 20s that mimed masturbation. This was one of Edward Bernays's, the father of propaganda. This was one of his first gigs. And so, you know, Sue admits in my interview with her that she was one of the Vaclav Nijinsky dancers.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I mean, you couldn't, just a direct tie in there. And she admits it, but she can't, you know, she denies being a part of any of it, denies knowing any of it was going on, denies being called the freaks, deny.
She seemed to deny that there even was a freak group at all. I thought at some point you asked her if she could, you know, kind of talk about or name some of the other members of the group, and she was like, what, there was a group? We didn't have a, you know, it was just me and Vito, you know?
Sure.
That's what it seemed like she was trying to say, you know? I'm like, what is she talking about? Of course they have. Yeah, she couldn't even come up with the name Carl Frank. I never even heard her mention him. And he was a constant. I mean, he was photographed with Vito and her constantly. He was in movies with him. I mean, he was always around, and she couldn't even seem to remember that he was part of the group, you know? It's just, yeah, it was, I don't know, something seriously wrong with that gal. So...
Either that or she's on the payroll still selling the BS, and she thought that she could, you know, it's possible that she thought that we would buy her crap and not get together and do another show, you know, shortly after exposing all of the lies that she told during that show. You know, Dave, let me ask you, though.
What's her family background? I couldn't find much of anything on her. I'd be curious to know what her family was.
She admitted that her dad was a stealth bomber designer or something like, like the SR-71 type of plane designer, which, of course, fits the whole thing. But she's like, you know, and, you know, my dad was Intel. We never thought anything about it, you know.
That's shocking. That's Who would have guessed, you know?
Who would have guessed?
Wow.
Yeah. You know, and another thing is that she started working with Vito down at the art store. She says she was interested in art and all this stuff, but she was 16, so... I guess that really makes Vito a pedophile.
Yeah, that's another thing she didn't mention. That when she met, she was 16. He was like 50, I think. And when they got married, he waited till she was 18 to marry her, and he was 48 at the time, 30 years her senior. Which, she also kind of neglected the... Yeah, I mean, she still seems to be very protective towards the guy, even today, you know? It's... I'm sure he exerted a considerable amount of control over her, you know, to say the least. She looks, I mean, if you see her in some of the appearances she made in some of the videos, like Mondo Hollywood, her eyes just look like completely dead. I mean, she just looks like she's just completely zoned out.
Well, you know, that interview that she did on the BBC, she looks like she's high as a kite or something. I mean, we thought she was either high or just completely mind-controlled. But
she didn't even drink. I thought she told you that she didn't even drink.
She may have said she did, but she did say no. She did say that they smoked pot, and that was it.
Did she? Okay.
Yeah. She did admit that they used to smoke pot regularly, but that was it.
That would actually kind of fit with
what I was saying earlier. You know, we have been doing research on. The whole history of MK Ultra, et cetera, and there was this book that came out. St. Peter's Snow, and this guy Alan Piper wrote an article on it that was published last summer, and we wrote on it as well. But what was it? 10 years before Albert Hofmann, quote unquote, invented LSD, was a book called St. Peter's Snow, published in Europe, that discusses a drug made from a fungus off of wheat being used to start a new world religion, etc. I mean, you know, and they say that St. Peter's snow is what the ergot was called in the Alps. Of course, LSD was supposedly invented in Switzerland. So it's a really tight little story, but it actually reveals that Albert Hoffman was not the inventor of LSD, that they had already known about it and been working on it for quite some time. But, you know, this whole storyline is this them starting a whole new religion and everything. And then you flash forward 80 years and you look at what happened and you look at what this book says. You know, they're talking about, oh, you know, we can start a socialist revolution and we can get everybody believing in God again so that we can lead them our way, you know. And it's the book is by Leo Perutz. But it's just comical when you get the big picture of, you know, the whole agenda that they were selling. And we think that we've provided plenty of evidence to show that the true agenda was a postmodernism or a neo-feudalism. They were selling the whole thing out of the Esalen Institute, all of these people centered around Esalen and SRI, etc. And all seem to be promoting this same agenda, this same neo-feudalism. And then you fast forward, we found a recording of Terence McKenna admitting that he was an agent and a PR guy, just like Edward Bernays. And, you know, so he's the one that created this idea of the archaic revival. Well, Gregory Bateson, who was one of the key founders of the MKUltra program, he was all into using anthropology to subvert our culture. And
Margaret Mead's husband?
Right. They're both just dirty as hell. They were both at the Macy conferences. I mean, these two people basically wanted to destroy society and everything in it. So Gregory Bateson, he created a native revival, okay? And so what they did is they basically, the Soviets figured out that they could collide their culture with the indigenous Siberian shamanic culture to keep them all under control. And so Gregory Bateson created the term native revivalism to accomplish this. And then later McKenna remarketed this as the archaic revival. But, you know, we've also got Timothy Leary in that video conversation on LSD. He admits in that video that he and Kesey and all of this guy, well, he says me, you know, he's talking about all of our agents. And then he talks about, and those ones, you know, going all over the country on the bus, you know, it's like, or on buses, you know, it's like, who else is, let me think if I can figure this out. Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters. So he admits right there in this video that they're all agents. And he's right there with Humphrey Osmond and Oscar Janiger or Janiger and all of these guys, which shows that, you know, this whole thing was orchestrated.
Yeah, I believe very much so. You know, I mean, I've long believed that Leary and all of his associates were, you know, it amazes me that so many people still defend him, you know, and try to, you know, rationalize away all of his various statements and actions.
Dave, we think that the prison break story is phony too. I mean, it's just so prepared. And in a conversation on LSD, and Joe Atwell and I have been working on another article on this, but in there, they talk about how, you know, how Leary's book on the prison break was one of the best books, and I've got it, and it's crap. And, you know, one of the best prison break books ever written and all of this nonsense, and they compare it to that movie from the 70s with Dustin Hoffman. I'm forgetting the name off of the top of my head, but you know, they're comparing.
Dog Day Afternoon, was it? Or
No. I think it starts with a P or something like that. I'd have to pull it up on my other computer. But
yeah, I know which one you're talking about. I can't think of it right now.
Right. You know, so they're comparing it to all of this, you know, nonsense. And he's like, oh, but your story is way better. And this is Humphrey Osmond talking. Of course, Humphrey Osmond and Aldous Huxley hired Timothy Leary to promote the whole drug scene. The two of them hired Leary. And then, you know, just I don't know if you heard my recent interview with General Albert Stubblebine. He was the former head of Army Intelligence, Global Army Intelligence, and he admitted on my show that Aldous Huxley was the guy in charge of MKUltra.
Oh, really?
Yep.
That's quite possible. And, you know, just strangely enough, both Huxley and Leary show up in the Laurel Canyon, narrative. In various ways. One of the guys, who was it? Was it, trying to think of who, one of the guys who later emerged as one of the, big name, artists out of Laurel Canyon, musician, singer, songwriter, whatever, was supposedly worked as a traveling salesman, before his big break as a rock star. And one of his claims to fame was that he claimed that he had sold a vacuum cleaner to Aldous Huxley at his home just months before he died, almost concurrently with JFK. And also,
he did die the same day as JFK, didn't he?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, same day, like hours later, just hours after the assassination. Yeah, he turned up dead. Yeah, and also his granddaughter, who's known as Animal Huxley. I don't know if you've heard of her. She was the longtime girlfriend of, I think it was the bass player for Steppenwolf, for John Kay's band, one of the Lorcs. So you have the Huxley influence, and Leary actually lived in Laurel Canyon, kept a home in Laurel Canyon for a while before he later turned up.
Sure, that's right. Well, you know, that's funny that you say that, because in 1994 I was working for the Prop 215 for medical marijuana, and we had a fundraiser at, drumroll, Timothy Leary's house in Laurel Canyon or in Beverly Hills, wherever the hell it was. And so, I have a short little video of me in Tim Leary's backyard smoking a joint with the guy from like 94. And now I look back at that whole scene and what was going on, when it was like, oh my God, we were just in a hornet's nest of CIA. It's like when I went to the MAPS conference a couple years ago, and I knew then that they were all CIA and Intel, but stepping back now and seeing the broader picture, it's like, oh my God, they really are, these guys really are Intel. And they're, that what they're doing is they sell the psychedelic drugs as, the greatest new religion that's going to save everyone. Meanwhile, their goal is to really dumb everyone down. Like Aldous Huxley in his book Moksha, he talks about transcendence, spiritual transcendence, in his true idea of it. Actually meaning that you're so high and drugged out on quote-unquote soma that you don't care that you're a slave, or you don't care about your social condition. And so, he wanted to implement the Brave New World on society and have, the epsilons, the deltas, the betas, the alphas, etc. And so then they could control everybody. And essentially, this is why he was always promoting Eastern Hinduist philosophies, because this is all based on the Hindu caste society, and you have the Rig Vedic Soma. He's hanging out with Gordon Wasson at the Century Club with Alan Dulles and Eisenhower and these guys, and selling, so he hangs out with Gordon Wasson at the Century Club. And then what does Gordon Wasson do? He writes a book that Amanita muscaria is soma, which is heavily attacked by many scholars today. It was probably just a generic term for psychedelic or whatever. But, so then Wasson, who's there, goes and creates the term that identifies in most people's minds that the Amanita muscaria mushroom is soma. And, it just couldn't be any tighter a fit. And then if you go up the ladder the other direction towards Aldous and Julian Huxley's ancestors, their grandfather was Sir Thomas Henry Huxley, who was Charles Darwin's propaganda manager.
Yeah, I know there's very close ties between the Darwin and Huxley's and the who the Daltons, I think it is. Eugenics. The big eugenics crowd.
Yeah, that's exactly right. They're all eugenics, and you know, they even Sir Thomas Henry Huxley created the quote unquote X Club, right? Promote Darwin's work into society and social Darwinism. And so I was like, what the hell does the X Club mean? And then of course you go and you look in the Bible and X marks the spot. Anyone who is marked with the X is going to die, and you know, and all of this kind of stuff. So they start the X Club to go promote, to send 8 professors into key education centers to promote Darwin's work. And of course, Darwin had stolen it from Wallace or whoever, who stole it from Immanuel Kant. And Immanuel Kant is one of the, you know, king sophists of history.
Is one of the what now?
Oh, one of the leading sophists of history. You know, he's one of the founding people to get us to try to not trust our own 5 senses and to not go look things up. You can't know truth. You know, and that's a bit of a under-summarization, but I do recommend people check out David Harriman's research, The Philosophic Corruption of Physics. And he goes through and he shows the progression from Immanuel Kant into all of this other stuff, just plug Darwin right in there. And they all, you know, kind of stem from this one little tree. All of these eugenicists, and they all seem to go back to Immanuel Kant, who created the original ideas.
Yeah, it's a little beyond my current research.
Well, that's all right. I'm just throwing it out there because, it all just makes so many times.
It's a little deeper than I've gone yet. But very interesting stuff, I got to say.
So, you know, you and I were talking before. We had a conversation back in March for maybe an hour or so, and, you know, you had talked about Stuart Copeland and Miles Copeland, how basically Miles had intentionally named his organizations, you know, FBI Talent Agency, and there was the police and all this kind of stuff. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, that's actually been integrated into the book. You know, a lot of people have asked me, you know, because before it was a book, it's been a web series. It's been in development for, I don't know, like 5 or 6 years now.
Sure.
So it's been pretty well circulated, and I've gotten a lot of feedback on it. And one of the questions that I get constantly is, are you going to do the same thing with? And then there's a whole laundry list of, you know, are you going to do the same thing with the British invasion bands? Are you going to do the same thing with the Seattle grunge scene? Are you going to do the same thing with the punk and new wave scene? You know, and, you know, people are constantly asking me that, and which, you know, I'm sure would be fascinating to do, but, you know, there's only so many hours in the day and so many more years left in my life, and a lot of other conspiracies out there to look into, so I don't know that I'm inclined to.
Sure.
To dig too deeply, but one thing that I did dig into a little bit was the punk and new wave scene, because that was the one that kind of replaced the Laurel Canyon sounds. You know, as the Laurel Canyon scene was starting to fade away in the late 70s, early 80s is when we saw the punk and new wave thing come out.
And that was Miles, right?
Yeah, and that was, you know, the new way to rebel against the system, supposedly, you know, the punk and new wave. And, and what my research has revealed is that just to a remarkable degree, that whole scene was really kind of created, nurtured, promoted, and, you know, everything else by basically one family, the Copeland family, the 3 sons of Miles Axe Copeland Jr., who was a very high-level intelligence operative in one of the founding members of the OSS. What's that?
I was going to say he was the key founder of the OSS and a founding member of the CIA.
Yeah, absolutely. He served as station chief throughout the Middle East, in Egypt and in Lebanon and various hot spots around the Middle East. He was a key player in various coups down there, you know, the one that installed Nasser, the one that toppled Mossadegh, and, you know, he was a major player throughout the Middle East and Northern Africa for many, 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 many years. And his wife was an equally highly placed British intelligence operative. So they both had sterling intelligence pedigrees, and they had three sons, Stuart, Miles the Third, and Ian. And the three of them, I mean, just to a remarkable degree shaped that whole scene. You know, Miles started up IRS Records, International Records Syndicate, I think it was called, IRS Records, which ended up signing and recording and promoting just an incredibly large percentage of the big names that came out of that punk and new wave scene. And then meanwhile, brother Ian founded Frontier Booking International, a talent agency that went by the acronym FBI, and they were the ones who, you know, signed and managed and handled most of these same bands. And then Brother Stewart, of course, formed the Police. He was the founding member of the Police. He's the one that came up with the idea and came up with the name and the logo and all of that.
And now we have Sting, who travels around selling UNESCO and the UN's agenda to the world and helping, you know, helping Daniel
so
Pinchbeck and Reality Sandwich sell 2012.
But you have these three sons from the CIA father who founded these three entities named the FBI, the Police, and the IRS. And between those three entities, they just had a major influence on launching and shaping and nurturing that whole scene. I mean, it's hard to find a big name act from that era who did not have some connection to such a degree that the manager of the Clash once publicly said that that he suspected that they were part of some CIA conspiracy to create and form this scene, you know, because they just were so fully integrated into it in every way, shape, and form.
Sure, so, and then the Cure, B-52s they sold. They also sold, one of my old favorite bands, you know, Black Coffee in Bed and Pulling Muscles from a Shell and all of that stuff, you know. So all of these bands were promoted directly by the Copeland family, which is all tied into the CIA and Intel. Well, the founding people
and
Intel.
I mean, these three kids grew up literally within the CIA family. You know, they lived with their father in various embassies. You know, they were friends with the kids from other, you know, the oldest one, Miles the Third, the first company that he launched before he went into the music business was a security consulting firm in the Middle East, which his partner was like the son of the chief of Egypt's intelligence services. So he had these two sons of the intelligence services opening up a private security consulting firm in the Middle East. And he was known, it was well known, that Miles routinely answered the phone with the greeting, "Hello, this is the CIA, how can I help you?" You know, it purportedly as a joke. That's how he would answer the phone at his offices. And then from there, he went into being a music mogul, you know. from this background, growing up in these hot spots around the world, living in U.S. embassies under, you know, armed guard and you know, all of this political subterfuge going on, coups and plots and whatnot, and his father constantly being involved in this stuff. And then himself getting into the security consulting business, and then from that, somehow he becomes this huge titan of the music industry that shapes the whole, you know, new wave movement. And you know, the other brother, Ian, he voluntarily enlisted to go and serve in Vietnam, did intelligence work over in Vietnam, and liked it so much that he tried to re-enlist. You know, he was gung-ho while everybody else in the country is desperately trying to avoid the draft, this guy goes and signs up and volunteers to serve in an elite intelligence unit over there. And then afterwards, you know, he decides that he's going to be a music mogul as well. So, I mean, there's just no real natural progression from their background and their early, you know, history to what they became. You know, it just doesn't seem to really fit at all that these would be the guys that,
and then you have, and then you have the clubs that explode onto the Sunset Strip and Hollywood Boulevard, et cetera, in the early 60s that all just, you know, mushroom out, like you said earlier, pun intended, I'm sure. So, you know, what do you think about, let me ask you this, why don't we get into people like, and you mentioned Charles Manson earlier, what about him and Christopher Walken and Roman Polanski, you know, those guys?
Yeah, well, you know, again, they were also a huge part of launching this scene. You know, a lot of the so-called Young Turks, Dennis Hopper, Warren Beatty, Peter and Jane Fonda, Jack Nicholson, Bruce Dern, Sharon Tate, all those people who were very much a part of the Laurel Canyon scene, and many of them lived in Laurel Canyon. Peter Fonda, in fact, became such a key part of the scene that he actually recorded an entire solo folk rock album under his own name that mercifully was never released. But yeah, he was so close to the scene that he wanted to be one of them. And but anyway, they were the other key draw that really launched these bands, because they would regularly go out to the clubs, and it was widely publicized that they were going out to the clubs. So, you know, initially at least, a lot of the people that were going out, hitting out to the Sunset Strip and hitting up these new clubs that were just starting to make a name for themselves, they weren't there because they wanted to hear the Birds, you know. They were there, as I mentioned before, because they wanted to see this crazy acid-drenched spectacle going on the dance floor, but also because they had an opportunity to rub elbows with Steve McQueen or Warren Beatty or Jane Mansfield or one of these larger-than-life stars that were out mingling in the clubs with normal, everyday people. And they did it routinely, and it was very well publicized. You know, you would never see a big star do that now. You know, they don't even leave the house without an entourage, you know. But these people were just spilling out into the clubs on a nightly basis and played, you know, a key role in launching this whole scene. And, you know, the interesting thing about that is if you look into the backgrounds of these people, almost every single one of them is the son or daughter of an intelligence officer, you know. Dennis Hopper, before he died, admitted that his dad was an OSS officer. You know, Sharon Tate's dad was Lieutenant Colonel Paul Tate of the U.S. Air Force Intelligence, I believe it was. Bruce Dern's uncle was like Skull and Bones. You know, and right on down the line, every single one of these people, you know, come from that same, you know, that same background. And, you know, that can't possibly be a coincidence that this canyon filled up with rock stars and actors who all came from, you know, from that very same background. And so that was a key part of the scene as well. You know, it was a key part of making a name for these bands, a key reason that they got as big and popular as they did, one of the main reasons that the Sunset Strip scene happened at all, you know, because like I said before, these were new clubs that nobody had heard of and new bands that nobody had heard of, and, you know, this was a whole new thing, and they needed some way to get that launched, and the way they did that is through exploiting the popularity of these young movie stars and by putting together this troupe of crazed dancers who would go out in these wild clothes and wild hair and put on these just bizarre spectacles on the dance floor. And so that was how the scene originally got kickstarted, by not by the bands themselves, but by the club owners who had the amazing foresight to open these clubs just in time to catch the wave, and by the Hollywood stars and the freaks who showed up to, you know, attract attention and get, you know, and attract media attention and get people to want to come out to these clubs to see what the heck was going on there.
You come up with some new stuff recently that I heard regarding Stephen Still and David Crosby. Would you talk about them?
Stephen Still's dad was apparently some type of mercenary sort of a soldier of fortune, so to speak, who appears to have been frequently involved in hot spots down in Central America, El Salvador, I think, and Panama Canal Zone, and a few other places. You know, wherever there was some kind of CIA plots brewing, he seemed to show up, and so Stephen consequently relocated quite frequently, and at times lived with his father down in military type housing in various hot spots in Central America. And he later claimed to various people when he would be, particularly drunk or high or whatever, he would sometimes regale people with stories about how he had served, that he had actually been an operative in Vietnam in the early years, in the very early 60s. And you will find references to that in biographies of him and other writings on the era. And they're always dismissed. Everybody always dismisses them and says, well, you know, that couldn't, it was just drug-fueled delusions. It was, just idle boasting or whatever. Although it was kind of a weird thing to boast about when you were an icon of anti-war crowd, But... And it's always been written off because it's claimed that it couldn't have possibly happened because by the time there were foot soldiers in Vietnam, Stephen Stills was already in the public eye as part of Buffalo Springfield, and he remained in the public eye thereafter, so obviously there's no way that he could have actually served in Vietnam. But what all those explanations always ignore is the fact that we had people in Vietnam for many years before that under various covers, working as trainers, advisors, engineers, whatever, whatnot. You know, we had covert operatives in there for a very long time. And given Still's, upbringing and background, he would have made the perfect, the perfect age, he would have been the perfect choice for such an assignment. So, to me, it's not at all beyond the realm of possibility that maybe he actually did, And it's impossible for me to say, obviously, whether he did or not, but I'm not inclined to dismiss those stories as quickly as everyone else seems to be, because it does, to me, it seems like it could actually fit, and, it could explain a lot of things.
Sure,
and,
Let me just interject here. We've seen photos of David Crosby and his father, who is an intel agent, and David Crosby looks like Davy Crockett with the buckskin and all of this stuff on, right? And when you think of the whole neo-feudalist or new dark age agenda that we talked about recently in our Manufacturing the Deadhead article, that whole thing completely fits, their whole look and dress and all of that, again, fits right in, just like...
Yeah, I have a picture, it opens the book, actually, it's in the very front of the book, my publisher wanted to put it in there, of Jim Morrison in January 1964 on the bridge of the... USS Bonham Richard, or what I think it was called, the ship that his dad was the commander of. And it was taken just before his dad, just before the ship sailed out for the Tonkin Gulf and what would ultimately become the Tonkin Gulf incident. And just months before Jim himself emerged, as the Lizard King. And it's just startling that the metamorphosis that this guy went through in like a year's time is just absolutely uncanny. You look at this picture and he's just this very clean cut collegiate looking conservative, you know, kid. And then, you know, he just emerges as something entirely different, just like a year later, as this fully formed, rock god. And then not many years after that, in his final years, formed once again into this overweight, hairy, reclusive poet. You know, so, I mean, it's just this, a remarkably short span, like in 6 years' time or something, you had three completely different incarnations of Jim Morrison that, I mean, in some of the pictures, you'd never even know. It doesn't even look like the same person. It's amazing, that he was able to just completely reinvent himself to such a degree, and more than once. Which is why I have never really had a problem with the quote-unquote conspiracy theory that says that he faked his death and reinvented himself as something else entirely different, because he certainly had the capacity to do such a thing. But
well, sure, and wasn't his death timed exactly with the retirement of his dad's boat that launched Gulf of Tonkin? And speaking of which, in my interview with Supalengas,
the very same day, his dad gave like some kind of commencement speech on the very day that he supposedly died.
Well, wasn't it like the same hour or same minute or something? But even Supalengas, in my interview with her, tried to deny that the Gulf of Tonkin had anything to do with officially getting us into Vietnam.
I know. Yeah, she was way off on her timeline on Vietnam too. So I caught that. So yeah, well, you know, what are you gonna say? Like I say, there's not a lot in that interview, unfortunately, that has enough credibility to be of much use. So
right,
yeah, such is life.
Well, you know, let's Jim Morrison. So let's go into the possible faking of his death. What do you have on that? And you know, we've basically come to the same conclusions on that as you.
You know, he has said that he was on record as saying that he could see himself, you know, reinventing himself and being comfortable as like a corporate executive, you know, like a Wall Street type person. And it seems entirely credible to me, you know. I mean, I think his whole thing as a rock star was a sham to begin with, you know. I mean, the guy had just the most unlikely history for someone who emerged as a rock star. I mean, in interviews, he acknowledged that he never studied music. He did not know how to read or write music. He never learned to play an instrument, had no interest in learning to play an instrument. Before joining the Doors, he'd never sung. He didn't even much listen to music. He said he'd only been to one or two concerts in his life. So he'd spent no time around bands. He, you know, never really much experienced live music. He didn't even listen to much recorded music. He'd never sung. He didn't play an instrument. He couldn't read or write music. I mean, the guy had no interest in, by all accounts, until all of a sudden he decides to transform from this kid that's in this picture from 1964 into Jim Morrison, the rock god. Just out of nowhere, he suddenly becomes interested and wants to, and then after a couple of years of that, he just as quickly loses interest, decides that he's no longer a rock star and he just wants to be a poet and just wants to be left alone, and then he supposedly dies. So, you know, to me, it all adds up to the whole Doors thing was a sham, and he did his thing and then went on to do something else, and who knows what. But, you know, as far as hard evidence of that, you know, that's a whole nother issue entirely, you know. I mean, there were very few witnesses, you know. I mean, the whole thing was done in a very hush-hush manner, you know, with no autopsy, no viewing of the body, and not even any announcement that he was dead until the body was in the ground. And the whole thing just really, really doesn't add up for me on a whole lot of levels. But I don't know. What's your take?
Oh, we agree with you that, you know, and we think that the, you know, the timing with the retirement of his dad's ship And Jim Morrison, you know, his dad officially gets us into the Vietnam War. And then Jim becomes the official look and role model of the anti-war movement.
Almost simultaneously. I mean, just to an uncanny degree.
Talk about Hegelian dialectic, huh?
What's that?
I said talk about Hegelian dialectic. You know, problem, reaction, solution, right?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's all just a little too convenient. The timing and all the interconnections and his whole life arc. It's just it just doesn't add up, you know. So, but then again, you know, I mean, for most of these bands, I mean, if you look at the history of how these bands came together and how quickly they came together and achieved fame, it just doesn't add up. It just seems entirely manufactured. You know, the more you look at it, the more, you know, even going beyond the fact that these people all had very sinister family connections, just the way that the scene developed, the speed with which these bands just came together and were, you know, ushered into recording studios like within weeks of forming, and you know, I mean, the Buffalo Springfield was just bizarre. It's just mind-boggling.
Well,
you know,
sure.
You read the timeline of.
I was just going to say, in my interview with Sue, she says that the Byrds moved next door to them, and the drummer had never played drums before. He literally just picked up the drumsticks, walked into his studio, and became a rock star.
That is absolutely true. Absolutely true. Michael Clark had never held a pair of drumsticks in his hands. He had played like bongos on the beach or something, you know, as a beatnik dude or something. But he had never had this, and in fact, he didn't even own a drum set in the early sessions. He kept time by just pounding on cardboard boxes with his hands. You know, the guy had no concept of being a drummer. And their bass player had never played a bass. Chris Hillman, who he was a bluegrass musician, a mandolin player, and a very good one. Considered a virtuoso mandolin player, but a mandolin is a far cry from electric bass guitar. And the dude had never picked up a bass guitar in his life, and yet this band, you know, was thrown together and, you know, into the recording studio within like weeks. You know, they had a name, they had a first single, they had a, you know, a record company behind them, and they had recording sessions, and half the band had never even played there. Literally, their entire rhythm section had never even played their instruments before, you know? I mean, it was just absurd. And even, you know, Crosby wasn't that great a musician either, you know? He's a rhythm guitarist at best. And and Gene Clark, who was their best songwriter and probably their best singer, he wasn't really much, you know, he could strum along a little bit, but, I mean, he was basically relegated to playing the tambourine. You know, so the only guy in the entire band who was actually a musician was Jim McGuinn, who became Roger McGuinn, who was a very good 12-string guitar player, but he was the only one, you know. The other four had no clue what they were doing, and which is why on their early albums they aren't actually playing. They're studio musicians, the same studio musicians that played on the Monkees. You know, the Monkees got all kinds of flack for being a fake band, but the reality is that at least half of the Laurel Canyon bands were just as bad and had to have studio musicians put down and play their parts for them because they just were not really qualified to be doing what they were doing, you know? So how did that happen? You know, I mean, if you're putting together a band, why would you draft a bass player and a drummer? You know, there was plenty of session musicians in L.A. that they could have recruited, but they were after a look. They were after an image. They were after something other than, you know. So, yeah, they basically cast these people to play these parts as well as, you know, as if they were casting actors, because that's essentially what they were doing. And so, yeah, I mean, a lot of these bands just were not what they, you know, what we think of them being today, you know. And, you know, their music sounds great. There's a quote from some drummer, famous drummer, for one of the bands. And I wish I had it handy, but basically what he said was that he was devastated to learn that the 10 best drum, that his 10 favorite drummers of all time were actually all one guy who was the drummer for the Wrecking Crew, who played for the Byrds and the Mothers, or the Mamas and the Papas and the Doors and all kinds of the Monkees and all kinds of, you know, a lot of the songs that still to this day play daily on classic radio stations are being played by Hal Blaine and the rest of his Wrecking Crew. They are not being played by the musicians that everybody thinks they were played by. So there was a very, very synthetic quality to these bands, how they were put together and how quickly they achieved fame, despite the fact that they had no previous experience playing their instruments and didn't have any equipment or anything else. Nevertheless, they immediately got backing from the major, you know, studios. They were outfitted with equipment. They were given, you know, rehearsal time and recording time and promoted into these major stars, despite the fact that they were certainly not the most talented musicians in the country, you know. Their fame was not based on their talent, at least initially, you know. And some of them did learn, you know. Chris Hillman eventually became a very good bass player, you know. Dennis Wilson of the Beach Boys is considered by some people to have matured ultimately into a pretty good drummer. But in the beginning, he had no clue what he was doing. None of them did, you know. So, there was a very, very synthetic nature, and a lot of what people were hearing was actually not being performed by the people that they thought, you know, on their records. Of course, in their live performances, you know, it was actually the band, but then again, you had all these other distractions going on that were, you know, preventing the people from really listening that closely to how bad the music was, so... And I always get in trouble because people just have such a reverence for a lot of these artists.
Classic rock. Well, you know, let me just say this, and here's why I think it is. You know, obviously this entire thing from the 60s, late 60s, early 70s was manufactured and sold to us, which also explains why... they repeat the exact same music on these radio stations every day for the last, 50 plus years. And so what they've done is they've basically gotten most of society caught in a time warp where they're just playing the same music over and over and over and nothing sort of changes. They want people caught in that 60s psychedelic state of mind, that archaic revival that they were trying to push on us back then. And there was Jim Ladd, and interestingly he was at Tim Leary's house that day, but he did he was one of these early guys who created one of the early counterculture head figures. And he did a show in the late 70s that I've got a copy of regarding the origins of FM radio. And the issue was that AM radio was mono, but what they needed was to synchronize the hemispheres of the brain using beats of music, and they couldn't do it with the mono music. So they literally, and at the time there was only two FM stations around, they literally created the FM radio networks to then sell the rock and roll on top of it with it across the nation and then globally.
I did not know that. That doesn't surprise me, but
I'll get you a copy of this Jim Ladd talk. I think you're going to be floored, because when you plug in what you know and what I know and what we've been putting all together on this and fit what he's saying in that, you know, of course, you know, he's in there talking about how wonderful all of these musicians are, right? But if you just go through and read in between the lines and put in our research, you can see you know, a much clearer agenda of what was behind pushing FM radio. And then we have the same, I mean, look what they did to the black musicians in the 80s and 90s. I mean, you have this beautiful black music that comes out of the, you know, 10s, 20s, 30s, 40s, and then it becomes gangsta rap and just this crap for a while, you know, and it's always leading towards this degradation. They're always pushing degradation, dumb people down, you know, wreck their lives. Let's get them caught into crap, you know.
Yeah, it's you know, I mean, I will say this, that as much as I believe that the 60s scene was manufactured and that it was based more on who these people were and who they knew than what their actual talent was, overall, there seems to have been a lot more talent in the 60s than there is now. I mean, if you look at the current crop of people who are like storming the charts, people who have been, you know, manipulated into superstar status.
What about Miley Cyrus?
Out of nowhere, you have these instant stars like Miley Cyrus and Lady Gaga and Rihanna and Beyonce and Jay-Z and I don't know, whoever the hell else is out there. And it certainly isn't based on their talent. I mean, you would have a hard time making the argument that these people rose to the top of their field because they're the most talented people that we have to offer, you know.
This is the best of society. It's
becoming more and more obvious that that isn't the case, that it's not based on talent, that it's based on other factors. And the symbolism and the blatant ways in which these people are now promoting an agenda is just mind-boggling. So, you know, the 60s almost as manufactured and as contrived and as controlled as it was, it seems almost innocent, you know, compared to what we're seeing out there today, you know?
Sure. Well, you know, and you go back and you read Edward Bernays, and he lays it all out there. I mean, he admitted that they had to create these idols to give the people gods, to give them the illusion of religion. And that's what they were doing out there. And also another issue that I often think of about all of this is what they're playing on is the, you know, primates have alphas and betas and whatnot. So basically an alpha who has ill intentions uses a lot of peacocking. And when you look at all of the Hollywood stars, they all use this peacocking. Lady Gaga, Miley Cyrus, they're all about the peacocking and looking big. You know, it's like a cop. You know, a cop puts on a Halloween costume and a badge and a bulletproof vest underneath, and he's all puffed up and he looks big, and everybody goes, oh, look at him, you know. He can commit crimes that he would never commit otherwise if he didn't have that Halloween costume on, if he wasn't all puffed up, you know. And so, you know, this is the whole thing. I think, you know, the whole alpha beta relation to primates and peacocking is key. And so, you know, we just need to get the betas to, you know, and the epsilons and deltas from Huxley to wake up and realize that the peacocking is just a show. And, you know, you don't need to go waste your energy screaming after people that are put there to mislead you and to prevent you from seeing how you're being manipulated.
Yeah, it's I don't know. It's a weird world we live in these days. I just some of the stuff that passes for entertainment is just it's just mind-boggling to me. I don't know what to say about the state of the quote-unquote arts nowadays. It's we're definitely being sold the anti-hero more and more, you know. It's there's been a huge shift in that direction to where we're more and more encouraged to root for people that we would have never rooted for, you know, like 10, 20 years ago, you
sure.
know, like meth dealers and mafia kingpins and serial killers, you know. They had Dexter, serial killer is hero, and the mob boss, Tony Soprano, is hero, and Walter White is hero. You know, it's unbelievable now. I mean, the degree to which people who, you know, we would have had no respect, no sympathy for 10, 20 years ago are now our new icons, our new
sure.
heroes, our new role models almost, you know.
It's funny that you said Dexter, because I was just going to throw that out when you said it. And, yeah, it definitely
I hate that show. That show just appalls me. You know, I spent years researching serial killers and that whole sordid, slimy world. And, yeah, to see, you know, one glorified as some sort of anti-hero in this ridiculous plot line, that show just, I never had any...
I lost you. Are you there? There you are.
Yeah, I'm here.
You just dropped out for a second. But yeah, it's, you know, it's really interesting. But it's always promoting the degradation of society. If you look at it from one angle, you don't see it. But if you look at this multi-pronged attack on us that they're constantly hitting us and trying to degrade us, you know, if you just look at the tribal silver dollar size ear piercings and stuff that people walk around with now, if you just look at that, you don't see it. You know, it's not the one thing. It's these many things that they use to attack us. And when you put it all together, you can see the bigger picture. You know, who was, let me ask you, who was Paul Rothschild?
Paul Rothschild was the producer of The Doors and of Love and for a time of Janis Joplin, actually. He was a major mover and shaker behind the scenes. He had come out of the Cambridge folk scene where he worked at the famous, I think it was Club 47, which was sort of the hub of the whole folk movement in Cambridge, which really, in large part, gave birth to the Laurel Canyon movement. I mean, Laurel Canyon basically was created by taking the folk music of Cambridge and electrifying it and turning it into something much different. And so he came out of that scene and had not been able to come up with a whole lot of information on him, although he did serve in an intelligence unit. According to a little blurb that I found in, of all places, Sports Illustrated, you never know where you're going to find little nuggets of truth here and there. And, you know, would never have expected to be looking in Sports Illustrated to research a book on the Laurel Canyon music scene, manipulation of the Laurel Canyon music scene. But, you know, a little blurb that was in there, there's a writer by the name of Barney Rostang, I'm not sure how he pronounces his name, but he revealed in there that he had actually served in the very same intelligence unit as Paul Rothschild, strangely enough. So here's this guy, and you know, yet again, came from an intelligence background, was trained in some type of intelligence work, and then emerged as a major mover and shaker behind the scenes in the Laurel Canyon music scene, launching, two of the biggest bands that came out of there, Love with Arthur Lee and The Doors with our buddy Jim Morrison, and also Janis Joplin for a while. So a major mover and shaker. And he became, basically, he came out of this intelligence unit and became what many people back then would have probably described as sort of a demonic rock producer. He didn't have a real good, you know, real good reputation. He was pretty difficult guy to deal with, apparently. And so he had quite a reputation. And weirdly enough, this other guy, Barney Rostang, who served in the same intelligence unit as him, ended up writing the mass market paperback book, Phantom of the Paradise, from the movie that starred Paul Williams, who was also a Laurel Canyon resident. And that movie was about a demonic rock music producer, a guy who basically sold his soul to the devil for fame and fortune and was trying to convince this other kid to do likewise. And so, weirdly enough, out of this very same intelligence unit, you have one guy who becomes sort of this demonic rock music producer and another guy who writes a novel about a demonic rock music producer. You know, both out of the same intelligence unit. That doesn't really seem like a coincidence to me. You know, then again, I suspicious mind the kind of guy, but things like that just don't seem like they would happen by chance, you know? I think there was a definite agenda, being pursued there. So that's the Paul Rothschild story, kind of in a nutshell.
What did
he was not, as far as I know, his name is not spelled with an S. It's spelled differently than the Rothschild banking family. And as far as I know, he is not a member of the Rothschild banking family, but I could be mistaken. Maybe it's possible that he changed his name, you know, the spelling of his name somewhere along the line. But
didn't the family make that name up, though, from Red Shield or Rose Shield? So, wasn't the name just created only like a couple of hundred years ago? So wouldn't they all be? I'm just thinking that they would probably all be related if the name was created. You know what I mean?
I don't know. It's quite possible. It's, the sources that I've read say that he wasn't, but, you know, I wouldn't rule it out. It's quite possible, you know. I mean, it wouldn't shock me in the least, and it wouldn't be the first time that name popped up in this storyline. Henry Fonda, one of his wives, was Countess Albera Franchetti, who was not only the daughter of one of the top advisors to fascist dictator Mussolini, but was also a Rothschild. She was a descendant of Louise Rothschild, one of the prominent Rothschilds. So there are Rothschilds in the Fonda family tree that gave birth to, you know, Peter and Jane, who were part of the scene. So, Henry Fonda's squeaky clean liberal image may have been a little off, actually, based on some of the stuff that he seems to have gotten himself into. But anyway, the point is that the Rothschild name does pop up elsewhere, at least I think on another occasion too, but I can't quite place it right now. But it definitely does pop up in the storyline. But whether Paul Rothschild was one of them, I really can't say with any certainty whatsoever. So.
Do you know anything about William Mulholland and his ties to MKUltra and the CIA?
No, I mean, I know who William Mulholland was, but no, I've never read or heard anything about him in that context.
You know, and apparently both he and Houdini were often, taught agents how to do sleight of hand and how to steal things and pickpocket and do this sort of stuff, right? You know, so Mulholland gets a street named after him. And in fact, didn't Huxley also live on Mulholland Drive for a while?
Quite possibly. It's probably where he was living when he got sold. Supposedly got sold a vacuum cleaner. You know?
Right.
He's living somewhere very close, somewhere right in the area where all of this was going on. Yeah, I'm not sure exactly where, but yeah. So.
All right. So, what do you know about Houdini?
Houdini, he was an interesting guy, to say the least. He was, by the accounts of a couple of authors who did an extensive amount of research on him and who received corroboration from both Scotland Yard and from John McLaughlin, former honcho of the CIA, that Harry Houdini was a covert operative working for U.S. Intelligence, Scotland Yard, and for an international police agency. And that his traveling magic act was in large part a cover for covert operations, you know. And they point out a number of interesting things about him, like how his meteoric rise to fame, first of all, which, you know, would be paralleled by the Laurel Canyon crowd many decades later, because this was way back in, like, 1890s. And he had been a struggling magician, you know, just an unknown sleight of hand artist, nothing exceptional about him at all. He'd been struggling, living hand to mouth, he and his wife, you know. At times he'd had to take work as a circus freak just to put food on the table, and, you know, it was just no real career prospects for him whatsoever, until the day that he walked into Chicago police headquarters and met with a guy by the name of Wilkie, who would become the head of the U.S. Secret Service and was at the time like probably the most prominent quote unquote intel operative at the time. And as soon as he fell into Wilkie's orbit, he immediately started getting massive press coverage, front page press coverage, and within a year, he was the highest paid entertainer and the most celebrated entertainer in the country, making tons of money and just, you know, like out of nowhere. He went from poverty to superstardom in like a year. And then bizarrely, as soon as he had done that, he took off. He packed up and sailed off for Europe for like a few years, which in those days was like career suicide, basically, because there was no real, you know, cross-culture community, you know, entertainment, so to speak, in those days. You know, they had their people, we had ours, and we were separated by a big wide ocean. And so, you know, leaving this lucrative career that he had in America to go over to Europe, where he was completely unknown and had no prospects whatsoever, was a very, very strange thing to do, to say the least. It would have normally meant career suicide for a guy
He was doing intel, and wasn't he breaking out when he was supposedly doing a show and then go steal some documents or something and then slip back into his escape outfit?
He would frequently perform on stage, like behind a curtain or inside a box or whatever it is, and doing these very long, elaborate escapes where he would be out of view of the audience for extended periods of time, you know, and which was generally considered to be just to sort of build suspense. You know, basically these people would sit there for like an hour staring at an empty stage, you know, waiting to see if he emerged. And, what these authors have suggested and have provided some corroboration for is that he very likely was slipping out through a trap door and going off and doing whatever he was doing and coming back and slipping into a box or behind the curtain or whatever the case was, and that it was the perfect cover, because obviously someone can't be in two places at once, and if you're on a stage being observed by hundreds of people, you certainly can't be off somewhere else, you know, doing some kind of clandestine activity. So it was the perfect cover. And no sooner did he arrive, and as soon as he arrived in England, within like days, he met with a guy by the name of William Melville, who was Wilkie's counterpart in the UK. He was the head of a special branch of Scotland Yard and, you know, an early version of the, what would become, MI5 or MI6 or whatever the hell it is. And so he was the top-ranking counterpart in the UK. And the same thing happened. As soon as he met with this guy, all of a sudden he's being celebrated as the greatest thing since sliced bread and became a huge star overnight in the UK. And then he went to Germany, and the same thing. And then he went to Russia, same thing. And he went to, and everywhere they just rolled out the red carpet for this guy, gave him massive publicity, hailed him as the greatest entertainer of all time. And the whole time he was, by these authors' accounts, he was doing intel work. And that's why he was, you know, welcomed with open arms and heavily promoted and whatnot, because he was working within an intel network, you know, and all the people around, his booking agent was intel, and, you know, all the people around him on the during his travels and all the people he met with, were very highly placed intelligence operatives. So
did he spend time debunking the spiritualist movement too, or am I confusing him with someone?
That's how he spent his closing years, actually, his last several years. That was his main preoccupation, was debunking the spiritualist movement, which was huge in like the 1920s.
Like it is now.
Late teens and 20s. Yeah, because after World War One ended in 1918, I think, we had a lot of casualties. We lost a lot of people over there, and a lot of people were very quick to exploit that by claiming that they could put these grieving families in touch with the family members that had been lost during the war, you know. And so you had all these mediums popping up and this whole spiritualist movement developing and making a lot of money off of people's grief. And so Harry Houdini was supposedly going to debunk that, and he did a lot of work. But, you know, ultimately, as with everything, you know, there's no such thing as bad publicity, you know. Any publicity is good publicity, as they say. And ultimately, what he ended up doing was heightening even more so the awareness of the spiritualist movement, you know, which contained a lot of big names. And some of his best friends were members of this movement that he was supposedly trying to debunk. You know, people like Arthur Conan Doyle, creator of Sherlock Holmes, was one of the main movers and shakers behind the spiritualist movement, and also a very close friend of Harry Houdini. So, you know, you got to wonder how sincere his efforts really were. But, yeah, that's what he always spent his final years. And according to some people, that's why he was killed, because of his investigations into the spiritualist movement.
Speaking of Sherlock Holmes, there's another show that they literally remake every single year.
I know, don't they? Yeah, you mentioned before the music. You know, I've kind of rediscovered my love for the classic 60s, early 70s music over the last 5 years or so, researching this, you know, this Laurel Canyon thing. And I find myself more and more listening when I'm listening to the radio, tuning into like classic rock and deep track type stations on Sirius Radio and stuff. And at first it was like a breath of fresh air, you know. I'm like, wow, this is great. It's such a great change from the stations I normally listen to that have a playlist of like 12 songs that they repeat endlessly all day long. But after listening to it for a few weeks, I realized it's just as bad, you know. And there's only so many times you can hear Magic Carpet Ride, you know. It's like they play that song like hourly, it seems like. You know, and I'm like, come on, there's a lot of music. But it's the same thing, you know. They got this very limited playlist, and they just hammer you over the head day after day with the same damn songs over and over and over again.
I'm glad you mentioned that song, because you also notice, aside from this neo-feudalist New Dark Age that they're always selling, the archaic revival, they're always also selling magic in the media, either, you know, via the music, you know, do you believe in magic, etc. And then this Magic Carpet Ride, you know. So what they want to do is get everybody away from critical thinking and into magical thinking, into Huxley's, you know, Brave New World worth of thinking. And this stuff goes all the way back to the Mahabharata as well, and how the ancient Hindus, you know, the Hindu castes, the Brahmin caste, did mind control on the rest of society. That's basically what we're looking at here. But, you know, it's just the same thing. It goes from, you know, music to film to whatever. Harry Potter selling that same magic theme, you know.
Yeah, absolutely, you know. And it was a big, you know, was definitely a big part of the Laurel Canyon scene. I mean, you know, a lot of these people were like reading Blavatsky, and they were reading Crowley, and you know, they were following all of that stuff. And it's reflected in, you know, some of the song titles and some of the band names and whatnot. The early band names especially, like the Mamas and the Papas. John Phillips initially called them the Magic Circle, spelled with both words the occult spellings, M-I-G-I-C-K and like C-Y-R-C-L-E or something like that, the Magic Circle, which was, you know, a direct occult reference.
Sure. Well, you know, the interesting thing about the word, the whole magic idea, if you look at the word abracadabra, abracadabra is actually A-B-C-D. It's also based from the word abecedarian, one who studies their ABCs. And so when you think that magic is based on spelling and casting spells, it's all about using words and sophist trickery to manipulate people, and that's really what magi is. And so therefore we have the magistrate who, you know, writes laws, etc. And this goes back to ancient Egyptian worship and how they did their rituals and control. So this, you know, this whole magic theme, magic and mysticism, you know, the word mystic, to mystify, comes from to befuddle or to confuse. So the, you know, the mystics and the magicians, etc., they've always been the sophists, the sleight of handers, and the tricksters throughout history. And then what they've done is they've sold their own sophism to make it a, you know, a spiritual thing, and then people go around following logical fallacies and the secret rather than doing something with their lives.
Yeah, absolutely. My brain was drifting there for a minute because I was just remembering that I sent one of the people that I sent my book manuscript to for a review was my mother, my aging mother, who's 80 now. And one of the corrections she sent back to me was that I had, in one place, I had spelled the word magic with a K, M-H, with a K on the end, indicating that it referred to like occult magic rather than, you know, like stage magic. And that was one of the things that she sent back as a correction, telling me that I had misspelled the word magic. So old mom is a little out of touch with those kind of things, but unfortunately, it's a very pervasive part of the world that we live in, you know, and you have to have some awareness and knowledge of that to really fully understand the world we live in and why things happen the way that they do, you know.
Yeah, I sure agree with that. You know, well, David, I know you got to get going here in about 10, 15 minutes. So, you know, there are a whole lot more questions that we could go into here. Maybe we should do another show sometime soon if you'd like. I'd love to have you back.
Sure, yeah. When I'm hopefully, I have one more insane month to go. Today is actually my first day I've had off in like a month and probably the last one that I'll have before Christmas. But once I get through this ridiculously busy period and wrap up a couple of jobs and get this book finally in its finalized form, which is a very nerve-wracking process for me. You know, I haven't published a book since 2005, I think. Yeah, 2005 was the last. So it's been 9 years. By the time this comes out in early next year, it will have been 9 years since I went the publishing route, and I've just done everything just on the web. And the beauty of that is that I can go back and correct stuff anytime I want. You know, if I realize that I made a mistake here or there, or that something's worded a little awkwardly, or there's a typo here or there, I can go back and correct anytime I want. You know, but once you put something in, once you publish it as a book, it exists in that form forever, and you just got to live with anything that, you know, slipped by your radar. So it's a very nerve-wracking experience for me, because I'm kind of a perfectionist, and I can barely go back and read my old books now, because I just hone right in on mistakes that shouldn't have been there. And so I'm just like obsessed with this one, with like achieving the impossible state of perfection, which sure, I will never achieve, but I'm trying very hard, and it's very hard for me to give them final approval and give them the green light and say, okay, that's as good as it gets, go ahead and print it, you know.
It's like giving birth. It's like, you know, writing a book is like giving birth.
So I've been struggling with that for the last few months now, just going over and over. I've reread this manuscript so many times, I just never want to read it again, and I just can't wait to, thank you, just can't wait to get it to bed and have my part all done and turn it over to them and let them do their thing and just have it out of my hair and hope that when the book comes out it will actually be in a near perfect form, because there's no such thing as perfection. But you know, and the reality is that I could go through this manuscript and proofread and edit it 50 times, and on the 51st time, I'd still find things that I think I could do better, you know? So,
I know.
At some point, you just got to say, that's got to be good enough, and I got to let this go and turn it over to them and let them do their thing. And so hopefully by the end of the year, I will have the book out of my hair and a couple of jobs out of my hair and have a little more free time to do this again. So,
well, you know, there was one other person
I
wanted to, before I let you go here, you know, there was one other person that I wanted to ask you about that I forgot about, and that's Governor Jerry Brown. What do you have to say about that guy? I've actually met him, but I'll spare it for now.
He is on the verge of becoming the longest-serving governor in California history for an unprecedented fourth term he's coming up for if he decides to run, which everyone assumes that he will because he has no competition right now, apparently. He's wildly popular this time around. I don't know why.
I've met him. He's an awful guy. He's an awful guy. What's that?
Maybe because his predecessor was Arnold Schwarzenegger, he looked good in comparison. But anyway, he was a part of the Laurel Canyon crowd. He actually lived in Laurel Canyon in the late 60s on a house on Wonderland Avenue, just a walking distance from where the Wonderland murders went down at 8763 Wonderland Avenue. He lived just literally a stone's throw from there down Wonderland Avenue, and was very much a part of that scene, you know, was linked to various members of the Eagles and to Jackson Brown, was romantically linked to Linda Ronstadt, and, you know, was a fully integrated member of the Laurel Canyon scene and a resident there not long before he emerged as our governor the first time around, when he was known as, you know, Governor Moonbeam, supposedly the so liberal that he was, you know, the press just painted him as like the ultimate, you know, far left liberal, which was pretty far removed from reality, but that's the way he was portrayed. But the curious thing about that is that the guy who was elected to serve as his lieutenant governor, Mike Curb, also was a Laurel Canyon fixture. He was actually the guy that the sound guy on the movie we were talking about earlier, Mondo Hollywood, and on a lot of the other movies that came out of that whole nexus of.
Now we know he's qualified to be lieutenant governor.
Yeah,
sound guy to lieutenant governor.
And then he became a producer. I think he actually opened his own label at one time, and so he was a major, you know, he was a pretty major behind-the-scenes figure in Laurel Canyon as well, and he was very staunchly conservative, whereas Brown was, you know, very far-left liberal, and they were elected together as a tag team. Both of these guys who just happened to have come out of Laurel Canyon just you know, not many years before, with, you know, Jerry Brown is the liberal, and Mike Curb as his underling conservative. And Jerry Brown, of course, very soon decided that what he really wanted to do was run for president. So he was out of the state frequently during his second term, I believe it was, on, you know, campaigning, trying to drum up, you know, start a presidential campaign. And so while he was out of the state, Mike Curb was the acting governor. And Curb put all of the, you know, signed all of this very reactionary legislation, you know, that was like way removed from what the people thought that they were getting when they elected this guy that was, you know, portrayed as practically a hippie, you know, Jerry Brown, Governor Moonbeam, you know, that was what the people wanted. And you know, the spirit of the times, you know, so they put this very, very liberal governor in Sacramento, thinking that he was going to govern accordingly, and instead he spent most of his time out of state and let Curb run things with a completely different agenda. And so now they are kind of able to really subvert the will of the people, of what the people had envisioned when they elected this guy. And yet Jerry Brown kept his hands clean because he wasn't the one that was actually doing it. He was out of state, and, you know, it was Curb that was running amok. And so you had this very interesting tag team dynamic going on in Sacramento with these two guys who appeared to be polar opposites and who both came from this very same Laurel Canyon scene. So, you know, another interesting aspect of the... and there were a lot of political figures bouncing around in Laurel Canyon that really shouldn't, you know, really should not have been there. I have reports of a cowboy service, a male bordello operating in Laurel Canyon that, according to some reports, serviced the elite of the political, military, law enforcement, corporate elite, including J. Edgar Hoover is one of their star clients. So, you know, according to these guys, J. Edgar Hoover was regularly tooling his way through Laurel Canyon to be serviced by this guy's male escorts. And you also had this guy Albert Wolfstetter, who was one of the guiding lights of the Rand Corporation, one of the guys who helped get the Rand Corporation off the ground and was one of the sort of the directors for many years, along with his wife, who also worked there. And he lived in Laurel Canyon. And his little social group at the time included a lot of the people who would later emerge as sort of his neocon cabal. Galame, Kalilzad, and I think Paul Wolfowitz, and I don't know, a couple of these other guys were his followers, and they would all, you know, I have accounts of that, that these people would all routinely gather in Wolfstetter's Laurel Canyon home and sit around in a circle and, you know, do their thing, planning whatever it is, you know, world domination or whatever it is. So,
between there, you know, and the you have all these rocks.
You have all these countercultural icons, so to speak, in the form of rock stars and movie stars, and they're freely mingling with, you know, people like J. Edgar Hoover and the neocon cabal and future Governor Jerry Brown and future Lieutenant Governor Mike Curb and, you know, all these people who would soon emerge as these high-powered political figures who just happened to be bouncing around that very same scene. You know, this, you know, peace and love and flower scene, they just don't quite seem to fit, you know. So that's a whole other aspect.
Wasn't Jim Jones, wasn't he associated with Brown in some way, too?
I don't know if he was definitely associated with the two guys that got whacked up in San Francisco, Melk and Moscone.
Sure. You know, and I know Dennis Perrone, who ran for governor, you know, a decade and a half ago for the medical marijuana movement. And in fact, in the opening line of the Harvey Milk film, they actually mentioned Dennis Perrone's name. But, you know, Dennis Perrone actually knew Jim Jones, too. But, you know, it's pretty clear to me that the whole Jonestown massacre was a CIA operation to see how many people they could get to commit mass suicide at once.
Yeah, that is a cleanup effort. They had to get rid of all any potential witnesses. I mean, it definitely wasn't. It was something far different from what you know has been portrayed in the media all these years. Definitely, and there were other deaths connected to it as well. You know, like Milk and Moscone, but of course that's never mentioned. As you know, supposedly we're just supposed to believe that some crazed ex-cop or something just decided to go in there and gun them down because I don't know why, but. Whatever reason, and then evoked the Twinkie defense. Remember that one? That was awesome, wasn't it? Remember the Twinkie defense?
No, I didn't remember the Twinkie defense.
Yeah, the guy that shot Milk and Moscone. What was his name? Dan White, I think. He was like some deranged cop or something. Yeah, that was when they evoked the Twinkie.
Was
defense.
He a cop or was he working cap? In a? Was he a cop or was he working in the government there with Milk and the others? I don't remember exactly.
I think he was a former cop. I'm not sure, but I remember they invoked the Twinkie defense. It was he had diminished capacity because he'd eaten too many sweets or some kind of crazy ass thing like that. And I think he actually ended up getting off pretty easily, considering what he did. But I don't know, that's a whole other story entirely, I suppose.
What is the single most important concept that you would like people to understand from your work on Laurel Canyon?
I would say that the single most important thing to take away is that we tend to give, we are a very celebrity-driven culture, I mean, obviously, to like a ridiculous degree, and we confer upon our celebrities an incredible amount of influence, you know? I mean, they're like on par with, you know, with our political leaders, and, you know, you mentioned, who was it you mentioned, Sting or whoever running around, Bono, you know, Bono traipsing around Africa.
Sure, yeah,
with,
Bono's another good
with
one.
With the president of the World Bank. But, yeah, the billions that we confer, we give, and a lot of that is manufactured, as you pointed out, you know, the manufacturing of icons of false gods and whatnot. And that is why, that is exactly why these people, or one of the reasons, that these people are so valuable as intelligence assets, because they have an incredible amount of influence. You know, they have a lot of influence.
Well, not only that, but if you're in a band, you know, and let's say, you know, in the 60s, the CIA and the government want to promote this whole drug theme all over the world. You got a band, you put them on tour. So now they're flying all over the world, dispensing LSD in every major city, right? And
that's another thing that they have access that, that mere mortals like you and I don't have. You know, I mean, big stars like Lady Gaga—they're welcome with open arms anywhere in the world where they go. They're given access that we wouldn't have, and they have influence that we don't have. And you know, for both of those reasons, they make very, very good intelligence assets, and that goes back a long way. You know, we talked about Houdini. You know, John Wilkes Booth. There's evidence that, you know, compelling evidence that John Wilkes Booth was an actor / intelligence operative 150 years ago. You know, I mean, I've come across evidence indicating that William Shakespeare was an intelligence operative as well as being an actor and playwright.
And very well could have been female in at that.
So. Yeah, you know, so this is a practice that goes back a very, very long time, and there are very good reasons for it. You know, as we've covered, these people have great influence, and they have access, and, you know, they are tailor-made to serve the agenda of the powers that be. So the main message I would say to you out of this book is stop looking to your celebrities for advice, or stop looking to your celebrities on, you know,
stop looking up to them.
Anything, really. You know, because you may think that your celebrities are rebels, and they're going to tell you stuff that the government's not, or whatever, and they're going to, but don't bank on that, is all I'm saying, because these people, for the most part, are very much a part of the power structure, and they're selling the same agenda, basically, and don't follow them. That would be my advice. If you want to enjoy their art, you want to listen to their music, watch their movies, TV shows, whatever, hey, you know, more power to you. But do not allow these people to influence your viewpoints, because they are not telling you the truth, and they are not who they appear to be. That would be, I think, my main, I guess, message.
Very
something
good
along
point.
Those lines.
All right, what's your website, Dave?
My website is, my very primitive website is, the name is Center for an Informed America. It's www.daveswebb.cnchost.com. I also now have a Facebook page up for my book, which is at www.facebook.com/weirdscenesinsidethecanyon, all written as one word with no punctuation or spaces or anything. And as far as I know, that is it's a publicly accessible page. You don't have to be a member of the Facebook community to access it. And that is where I have been posting all of the sort of graphics that go along with the story, all the photos, my own photos, and various other photos of all the different people and places, so you can kind of have the visuals. And where I'm also posting any updates as far as the publication date and cover price and whether I'm going to have signed copies available and all of that kind of stuff. So that is the place to go to keep tabs on what's going on with the upcoming book. And my publisher tells me it's very important that I shamelessly pander for likes for my Facebook page, because they keep telling me that social media is a major advertising stream or some such thing these days, and that you have to exploit the I hate social media, I gotta tell you.
Right, so do I. I gotta use it, but
my publisher is making me do it. They conned me into setting up this Facebook page. I don't know that I'm gonna do anything. I don't have a Twitter account or any. I don't have any other social media resources, but I am keeping this Facebook page up to date. And if anybody likes it, then I guess go ahead and hit the little like button, because likes are some kind of measure of something. I don't know what, but you're nothing in this world if you don't have likes on Facebook, I guess. So. That's what my publisher tells me anyway. Whatever.
That's funny. So, what is the title of the book going to be, the final title?
It is Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, Laurel Canyon, Covert Ops, and the Dark Heart of the Hippie Dream. And it's actually available right now for pre-order on Amazon. You can pre-order it for shipment as soon as it's released. It has its own little Amazon page now.
Release date?
The release date that's listed on there is April 30th, but I don't think that's right. It's also listed on BarnesandNoble.com for pre-order, and the release date there is March 4th, and a press release that my publisher sent to me a couple months ago that he said was going out to distributors had a date of like March 16th. So I have no idea. I've seen at least three different release dates.
So sometime between March and April.
Sometime in March or April, it will come out, yes. That's what I'm told. Well, they're going to do a limited edition hardback before that. That is the trade paperback release. And they're doing they do some kind of a limited edition hardback where, which I don't understand the legalities of it, but they do like a hardbound thing that has no ISBN number.
Sure, and then you sign each one, sign a number each one.
So they produce it themselves that way, and apparently it's much cheaper than doing it the normal way. And they said that's really the only way that they can do it, to produce hardcovers that are cost effective. But that means that they can only sell them through their own website, or maybe to me in a bulk purchase, which I can then resell. They can't sell them through any bookstores or online dealers or anything like that. Technically speaking, the book doesn't actually exist because it doesn't have an ISBN number, but they do actually exist.
Sure.
And they're going to have a run of those. So that will actually be out earlier, and I have no idea what the release date of that is, or how many copies will be available, or what the cost will be, or anything like that. So again, I'm going to post all that information as it comes available on the Facebook page. So,
good to hear. Well,
so that's the. Anyway, what time is it here?
We got to let you get going here, but
I gotta.
Anyway, I want to get one of those first copies of that hardbound autograph from you.
I have something like 150 requests currently for signed copies of that, and I have no idea if I'm even going to be able to get that many copies at this point. Initially, it was supposed to be out in like late November, early December for the Christmas buying, and I've had people really wanting as many as 6 of them to give out to friends and family members. Like, ah, put me down for 6 signed copies. I'm like, ah, kind of greedy, aren't you? And I was like, I have no idea if I'm even gonna have that many copies. But I've gotten requests for well over 100, probably close to 150 copies at this point, and there which I'll go. Be more than happy to sign and be more than happy to sign and send out if I actually get them myself. But at this point, I really don't know. So I mean, I would definitely be able to make a bulk purchase of the paperback and sign and, sure. and sell those. But again, that won't be till like March or April. So
yeah,
there's still a lot that's up in the air. But you know, as it becomes a little more clear to me, I will keep people updated on the Facebook page. So,
well, Dave, you know, one of these days I'd love to sit down with you and compare research notes, etc. You know, and we had talked before about maybe one day coming down there and getting you on camera. You know, when we talked last March or whatever. So, you know, maybe we can still put something together on video one of these days. But you know, thank you so much for all your time today and coming on the show.
Hey, no problem. Glad to do it. Sorry it took so long to get it together. Hopefully next time it won't take quite so long. And I'm hoping that I get a lot of requests for interviews, you know, around like March, April, once the book actually comes out, because I've been doing interviews for a long time on, you know, various radio shows, and I never really have anything to promote, you know. I'm just there to just jabber, you know, so I feel like I have an actual motive for doing these shows, you know. I actually have something to plug, which would be kind of a change of pace, so see how that goes, I guess, and I don't know. I'm very curious to see how this is received, both by, you know, rank and file readers, you know, just, you know, gauged on like Amazon reviews and whether anyone in the mainstream will actually bother to, you know, if it'll get any actual, you know, mainstream media reviews in any news, you know, is the New York Times going to review it? I don't think so. I'll be curious to see. And if they do review it, how thoroughly they trash it. So, we shall see. It's going to be it'll be interesting, because like I say, I have not ventured into the publishing thing in almost a decade. It's been a long time. So this is
before I forget, I know I sent it to you before. I don't know if you had a chance to read it, but my Manufacturing the Deadhead article, you may get some nuggets out of there regarding the Dead and Edward Bernays and how these bastards tie into the whole thing.
Wasn't the Dead's manager initially Courtney Love's dad?
That sounds probably familiar, something like that. I wouldn't be surprised. And yeah, there's so many
Hank,
times there.
His name's Hank something or another. I can't remember his last name, but I've heard that their original manager was
Dave Geffen.
Courtney Love's dad.
Dave Geffen is in here, and then he's tied to Cher, Ken Kesey, Yoko Ono, all of these dead people, you know. Crosby, Stills, Nash, Grateful Dead, Guns N' Roses, John Lennon. And, I'm not sure who her dad was, but she worked with Dave Geffen, and he's tied with all the dead people. Oh, Hank Harrison is here. And, yes, he was tied to the Grateful Dead.
Hank Harrison. Yeah, that's Courtney Love's dad, yeah. And
he was involved with the dead.
Repeatedly a CIA operative.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was reputedly a CIA op, too. I've heard that Courtney Love can actually be seen in some old pictures with the band as a little toddler, a little toe-headed little girl. She can actually be seen in some of the early dead photographs, from what I've heard. I don't know if that's true or not, but anyway, yeah, everything's connected. Everyone's connected. So anyway, very good talking to you, and we should do it again sometime after the first of the year when my work is quieted down and the holidays are over and the book's in the can and I can kind of get back to a normal pace of life, hopefully.
Sounds good. I'll talk to you then. Have a good day.
All right, man. All right, you too.
Whenever it starts and it's magic, if the music is groovy, it makes you feel happy like an old-time movie. I'll tell you about the magic and the free of soul, but it's like trying to tell a stranger about a rock and roll. Believe in magic. Don't bother to choose if it's jug and music or rhythm and blues. Just go and listen.
Giving you a number and digging away your name.